Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is
Dan Appleton.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper. Wednesday, May 8th, 2024.
Okay.
Belated happy birthday, Zeke.
Yeah. Well, no, we were there. We were there to wish him a happy birthday. Don't give people the impression.
We did more than wish him a happy birthday.
Yeah, we went out.
Pepper and I made a fantastic cake. Two cakes, to be honest.
We flew out to California for Zeke's birthday. And spent time with the little Zeke family, Zeke Noel, Pepper, and your favorite.
Oh, please don't
Hazel.
Say that.
Hey, like, not
you're not allowed to say that.
Well, she's not your favorite anyway. But you had a good time with Pepper and with Hazel.
I can't believe you said that.
I'm sorry.
That is such a rookie mistake for a grandparent.
And it's not true anyway. I mean, so Hazel's 10 months and Pepper is 3 years and several months going on, 41 or 42, as far as we can tell. She's growing up fast. And you're right, Pepper was a tremendous help making the cake, especially the quality testing.
Yeah,
right?
It was a chocolate cake with peanut butter filling and a ganache draping over the whole thing.
Yeah.
Quite rich.
Yeah, well, Pepper was, I saw her doing a little stirring and doing a little tasting of the frosting.
It's a big cake.
Yes, it is.
And
so we had
a lot of batter, so she made an extra little teeny tiny cake.
Which she was very proud of. She was very proud of.
And so, it was cold out there. It is so cold in California.
I don't understand
what the fuss is about. It's cold in California.
Yeah, and we go every May, and we go other times too, but we're there in May, and I'm with you.
We were freezing.
It's freezing cold. The highs would be 63, 64, 65. Windy, although I will say this about California.
Gale force winds.
When the sun is out, it's quite warm. The sun isn't out very often, but when the sun is out, you feel it. And we're by the ocean a lot. We're getting the winds. Anyway, we like where we are. We are by the water a lot, by the ocean a lot. Zeke's got a very nice backyard. Zeke Noel really fixed it up. So we're out the doors a fair bit there. And that's part of why we experienced the weather. It feels so strong.
We weren't so cold at their house as we were cold in, say, the restaurants. You know, you would be outside at a restaurant.
Eat outside. Yeah.
And it would be chilly. But I had one great nature experience.
Which is?
Well, several great. I have been walking along the beach. I did see dolphins jumping up and down in the water. And I also, strewn along the shore, were these things. They look like little plastic discs or weird things. And clearly they weren't. They were some kind of natural thing. And I found out they're called velella. Sometimes they're called velella, and they're somehow related to jellyfish, as in man o' war. Mm-hmm. And they're these little blue discs with a kind of a clear, seemingly plastic sail attached to the top. And they ride on the surface and wind blows them about. It's an extraordinary design. It's an extraordinary thing to see. I feel bad for them. They're washing up on the shore.
Many of them washed up on the shore. That's where we saw them.
Yeah. And they say that could be the mild winter, the warm water. They're not sure. Some environmental oddity is making that happen. But velella.
Well, my nature experience was at our Airbnb. There was a lot of trees around. And there's a tree, the biggest tree. It's sort of shadows, the Airbnb, was filled with a nest of herons who make a lot of noise. And your first reaction is, heron, that's fantastic. But if you look it up, turns out that herons are considered a pest by a lot of people. And the first thing you see, maybe it's just this part of the country, is a lot of articles about how to get rid of herons. And the answer is it's quite difficult. And I can understand why, because they make a heck of a lot of noise. So, different view of herons following that trip to California.
But we had a lot of fun with the kiddos, too. And we got to observe their swimming lesson.
Yes.
A lot of splishing, splashing, not a terrific amount of swimming.
No.
But again, it was chilly.
Yeah.
Chilly. I don't know how they make those kids get in the water.
They got their work.
Must have been heated water. Yeah. I'll say that.
They'll do better in July.
But, you know, it's both girls are learning things every day. Mm-hmm. And it's just fun to observe all of this.
And they have cute outfits.
And they have cute outfits.
So the other part of the trip, of course, is the airplane ride, which was fine. And we saw a couple of movies.
It's a small thing.
No, it's not a small thing. And we saw on the way out, we both watched the Anatomy of a Fall, which was a very highly acclaimed French film, 2023. And I noticed the Rotten Tomatoes score was 96%. I think it was over 90%, both the critics and the audience. And it's a fairly serious film about a family in which the man falls from the second floor and dies in this from this, I don't know what you call, skiing chalet, which is their home. And the question is...
In the Alps.
Yeah, in the Alps. How did this come about? Was it a suicide attempt? Did he slip? Or was he pushed by his wife? And it culminates in a trial of the wife for murder in France, and under French procedure, which is somewhat peculiar.
Well, you really enjoyed watching the court scenes.
Well,
because they were so bizarre.
They were so bizarre,
And, you know, I don't know that much about court procedure.
It's not like
in
U.S.
general,
procedure. There's a lot
but it did seem strange.
Speechifying.
I mean, people were talking at odd times.
Yeah, it was like you were sitting around your living room and everybody was chiming in. It was kind of silly. And maybe that's the way it is in French courtrooms, and maybe it's not. I mean, it is a movie. But what did you think of the film?
I thought it was okay. It was a little bit bleak. You know, it's a little bit, you know, it's one of those European in the snow movies that can be a little bit atmospheric, but mm-hmm. in a bleak sort of way. But, you know, it did maintain my interest.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was largely about family relationships and, you know, who was doing what when. And
sort of,
you know,
recreating what happened.
Well, recreating what happened, and it reflected on each person's kind of success and each person's role in the family. Yeah. And, you know, was that disputed a little bit here or there?
Which was critical to figure out what actually happened, because they were trying to put together the motivations and the incentives of the various folks in the family, and perhaps to attribute guilt to the wife because there were some differences between the wife and the husband. So I did read some of the comments in the positive reviews in the Rotten Tomatoes, and they were saying, oh, yes, it does this. It's an interesting discussion or examination of these family relationships, interesting discussion or depiction of storytelling, if you will. Everyone has a different narrative as to what's going on. And the movie was quite worthwhile, although a little long. And that is 100% right. It was too long.
Yeah.
And it was too long, or another way of saying it, was pretty slow at times. Now, why do I harp on that? Because we were in an airplane. And there's a difference between, you know, sitting in a theater, and perhaps a higher level of attention is achievable in a theater versus sitting in an airplane. And I would say it's not the best airplane movie. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, but I would say also it's not the best movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a little slow. I should mention the actress is much acclaimed, Sandra Huller, who might even have been nominated for an Academy Award for that. I think she was. So in any event, but that's a highly acclaimed film. And on the way back, I went in a different direction. We didn't watch the same film. I saw a movie that was recommended to me called Inside Man. It was a film made in 2006 by Spike Lee. But it's not, to me, it's different quite a bit from most Spike Lee movies. It was a caper film, if you will. It was about a bank robbery and a hostage situation. Sort of like Dog Day Afternoon in terms of the frame of the plot, but quite a different film. And the great cast with Denzel Washington and Jodie Foster and Clive Owen and Willem Dafoe and Christopher Plummer. And I thought it was excellent. I'm recommending this film. You can probably stream it. I'm sure you can. inside me. And it was, I enjoyed it as much as any Spike Lee movie I've seen. And the funniest thing about it is that it begins, you know, the opening sequence with credits, whatever. The music is an Indian music, a Bollywood musical number. And it closes with that same number. And there's a lot going on in the film in terms of levels and text and subtext. But you often, you find yourself asking yourself, or at least I did, why the Indian music? And I couldn't figure it out. And I looked it up, and the answer is, Spike Lee liked the song. Because a lot of people threw it in. Yeah. So anyway, I recommend Inside Man. So what is it that you watched?
I watched a terrible movie.
Well, good for you.
I watched A Haunting in Venice. And it, you know, it didn't get a great score in the little summaries that you can flip through mm-hmm. when you're choosing your movie. But, you know, it was made by Kenneth Branagh. And he was a star. Mm-hmm. And Tina Fey was in it. Camille Cotton from Call My Agent. You know, I thought, it's a mystery story. I knew it was going to be a little bit stagey, et cetera, but it was terrible. It was just, goofy. I almost stopped watching it, but what else was I going to do?
Well, you should have watched my movie.
I couldn't. You know, by the time I was figuring out this movie was terrible, I didn't have enough hours left to be watching your movie.
Right. You chalk up to experience.
You know, you think Venice, at least it's in Venice. Yeah. You think, at least these are good stars, but it's all kind of fakey and stagey.
Yeah,
and,
they were hamming it up.
You know, It's an Agatha. It's based on an Agatha Christie story.
Right? It's Kenneth Branagh as Poirot.
Poirot, yeah. So, you know. Yeah. And the Poirot character wasn't terrible, but I don't know. So that was that was a disappointment.
All right.
But.
A misfire.
Yeah.
Well, you take a chance. It is interesting when they give you this choice of movies, an airline, and it's a reminder of how many movies you don't want to see. I mean, they show you 200 films. It's like being in the old, movie rental stores years ago. Mm-hmm. And you'd be there 25 minutes. I didn't realize that so many movies have been made that I wouldn't see in a million years. Right.
So you know what? I am quite the voyeur.
Yeah.
On.
Really? The voyeur?
On the flights.
Yeah.
Because some planes now don't have any screens, right? Yeah. You have to bring your own personal entertainment, okay? Right. Some have the screens we had yesterday, which are just normal small screens, and you can look and see with the guy in front of you, with the guy to, the side, what they're watching. And I find that highly amusing, and sometimes I'm trying to figure out, guess what the movie is, even if it's something I haven't seen, but you can kind of piece it together or whatever. So I enjoy doing that. But then on the really sophisticated flights we go on now, you don't see anything on anybody's screen but your own.
Is that right?
Yeah. Even your like next door neighbor.
Really?
You know, yeah. I could look when I was flying with Sadie on British Air, I could look at Sadie's screen and it looked like it was blank. No kidding. It looked like she wasn't watching anything. And I kept thinking, why isn't she watching anything? And then I remembered, on some other flight we were on, I suppose it was the other British Air flight last summer. So I think that's really nice because first of all, you don't very often want to see what other people are watching. Yeah. And certainly if there are kids on the flight, you may not want your kids to be seeing what other people are watching.
You know what? That's two things. A couple things. Number one, I don't think that makes you a voyeur. I think that makes you nosy, which is a little bit different. But point two is what this reminds me of is Zeke's television. Zeke and Noel have a television from Samsung, which is a matte television. It's got a special name, but I don't know what the brand name is. And it does look a little different. It's not shiny. It's a flat aspect to it. And what really distinguishes it is when the television is off, they have it set up, as I think it's often set up, to show paintings. And the paintings look like paintings. I mean, at one point, I wasn't even thinking about it. And this is after I'd watched the television the day before. And I looked up. I said, well, that's a pretty nice painting that they have in the living room. Some still life from Cezanne or something like that. And it looked, it was stunning. It looked exactly like a painting.
Well, people have those now.
I understand that. I don't think Zeke had his own make, but I mean, I don't know if we would do that or not, because I'm not sure the television, when you're watching television, I'm not sure that it's
no, well, we have a weird TV setup, because our TV comes out from the wall at an angle.
It's not about us. My point is,
you wouldn't have a painting hanging at an angle the way our TV is.
Unless it was a really good one. But my point is, I was stunned by that. I mean, if anybody's thinking of getting TV and they say, I don't want a TV in the room because it's too obtrusive, this solves that problem. I mean, it really looks like a painting. It's crazy. All right. So
it does liven up their room.
Yeah, when it's the painting thing. It's crazy.
Because otherwise they don't, you know, they have more art hanging on their walls now, but they didn't used to. And so the only decoration would be the occasional plane of Frozen.
Right. And it's a big screen. So you see
it's a big screen.
So it's a life-size Shazam.
And speaking of that, we'll speak of that later.
I'm sorry. You can jump to any. I mean, what we're going to talk about at this point, because we want to recommend a Broadway show while there's still time to see it. If we've mentioned, we subscribe to Encores. Encores, there's three revival-type shows a year. And we tend to talk about the shows like 2 days before we see it. And by the time we broadcast, it's too late for anyone to get tickets because it's gone. These are just usually open for a week or 2 weeks at the most. So we want to give you some lead time. Encores is doing Titanic in the first couple weeks of May.
No.
On June.
June 11th through 23.
I meant to say June 11th through 23.
So the musical Titanic.
Yeah.
All right. They say it's returning to the New York stage for the first time in 20 years.
That's crazy.
Right?
Yeah.
This is the story and the book are by Peter Stone. Music and lyrics by Maury Yeston.
Right.
Okay. So it's the Titanic movie story, basically, that many of us know. But it's a musical, and it is terrific. Yes. Years and years ago, you bought me the cast album.
Before we saw it?
Before we saw
did
it.
Did I?
Because somebody had recommended it. You bought it as a Christmas gift.
Really?
Somebody had recommended it to you.
Yeah.
And they said one of the things they mentioned was it had a lot of male chorus
you like that.
Numbers.
Right.
And I love a male chorus.
Yeah.
I love the power of the male chorus. And you bought it for me, and I listened to it. It was kind of my go-to music, driving to and from my parents' house with the kids or picking up the kids when my parents were watching it. So it is wonderful. It has terrific music.
Well, you should
I don't know anybody who knows any of these songs. What?
We went and saw the musical. It's not just
we eventually saw the musical, but we loved it for years.
Yeah.
You know, but we saw it just before it closed, basically.
But you're not basing your evaluation on the CD. We actually saw the show. That's what I'm saying.
But I'm also saying, you know, not all of our loyal listeners are going to make it to this show.
Yeah.
But give the musical a listen on your Spotify or whatever. Titanic. This looks like it's going to be a good production. I'm usually wrong about that. But it has a lot of fun people in it. Chuck Cooper with his son Eddie Cooper. Chip Zien. Brandon Urinowitz, Judy Kuhn is in it, Raman
Carmelou. He's the biggest name.
Bonnie Milligan.
Yeah, Bonnie Milligan, who we saw on Kimberly Pimbo.
Really looks like a fun cast. All right, now let me tell you some other things about it. So they have special little notes on, we were sent an advertisement. We already have tickets to it, but they're, you know, they send out advertisements like crazy. If you go to the Saturday, June 22nd matinee, they have free childcare available.
You're kidding.
Can you believe that?
That's
it says, in partnership with the Parent Artist Advocacy League.
Wow.
And Broadway Babysitters, City Center's pleased to offer ticket holders free childcare at the June 22nd matinee. Pre-registration is required and space is limited. Never heard of that before. I mean, that's really kind of a fun idea. So, really, this is Titanic. Listen to it, go to it, do something.
So that no one's going on our say-so alone. 1997, it won the Tony for Best Musical. So it's not just us. So it's a pretty good show.
Well, lots of things win the Tony that you don't, you're not going to drop everything and go see ever.
It's a plus.
It was a plus. But it has, some of the songs are just so poignant. Well, and, you know, I love it.
All right.
I'm looking forward to it.
Speaking of Tony Awards, the play that's going to win the Tony for Best Play this year is Stereophonic. And what's interesting about Stereophonic is...
It's a play!
It's going to win for Best Play. But what's interesting about Stereophonic is...
is that it's a play.
You're jumping ahead. You're not listening to what I'm
saying. I am totally listening, okay?
Okay.
I'm emphasizing.
Yes. But it's also nominated for Best Score. That's the trick. Okay?
Right. But it's also Stereophonic. Even the name makes you think this is music-oriented, right?
It is music-oriented. So it's about...
But it's a play.
Yeah. But it's about this group, people who are forming a rock band, or formed a rock band, and the release of their new material, and the development of the new material, and their relationships, and whatever. And it's, you know, highly acclaimed. It really is going to run away with Tony for Best Play. But the question came up, how can it be nominated for Best Score also? And one of the reasons that's interesting is because they've been nominated in more categories than any other production in the history of the Tonys. And that's because they're straddling play on the one hand and musical on the other here. And it's an interesting explanation for this. And that is that the way the Tony Award for Best Musical has evolved is that while traditionally, or at least originally, plays with music were sort of reviews, there would just be musical performances in the course of a play. At a certain point, particularly with Showboat in Oklahoma, there was the development of the notion that the music would move the action along, that the music would be integrated in the narrative.
And so originally there was no Tony for a musical, just Tony for a play.
Originally there was no connection between the music and the narrative. Once there was the connection between the music and the narrative, then there was a thought that this is something that's a different animal.
This is different. Yeah.
So the Tonys began in 1947 or so, and they didn't have a special category for musical. But by 1949, particularly when there was the nomination of Kiss Me, Kate, someone said, you know something, this is just different from the non-musical entertainments we have. And it is a musical in the sense that the music moves the narrative. Therefore, we have a category called Best Musical, which went to Kiss Me, Kate. So that's the definition of a musical, the connection between the music and the narrative. Stereophonic, the music doesn't advance the action or the narrative. And therefore, it is not a musical in the sense of the Tonys, which is fair. But they do have a lot of music because that's what the characters are arguing about. They're creating something with this music, and they're arguing about, you know, changes that might be made to the music, changes in how they might perform the music. That's the action, even though the music itself, the words, whatever is going on, is not advancing the narrative. So it's separate. It's a play. I probably said too much about it. I want to see it. We have to see it. It's only open for another month or so. It's supposed to be fantastic. They say it's 3 hours long, but it doesn't feel like 3 hours long. That's the other thing I'm recommending.
Yeah, even I want to see it. And I have no interest in seeing the subject matter.
Okay.
You know, it sounds boring to me to, you know, watch a band come together, you know. Ugh.
All right. Okay. So we were going to talk about this article about how issues of mental health are now being discussed and presented to young people based on a study that was recently done, which suggested that the way that mental health is emphasized in a lot of schools and other institutional settings by urging people to speak about anything that might be mental health related, or at least what may be considered issues that people are having, tends to elevate the whatever people's experience is to something in the nature of a syndrome for which there is no solution, which is, quote, counterproductive. I mean, that's a bad summary.
Well,
it's tough to summarize.
Yeah. Basically, it's an article that's about programs that are designed to help students of a variety of ages deal with mental health. I mean, we're reading about increases in suicide, you know, all kinds of huge, seems to be a big mental health crisis going on for younger people. And with that in mind, programs have been developed to try to help kids deal with this, even at a young age, involving yoga, involving breathing, involving talking about, handling emotions, acknowledging emotions, et cetera, and so forth. And this article cites a bunch of studies from all different places, I think even different countries, because one major study is in the UK, saying that not only are these programs pretty much unsuccessful, to some extent, they seem to be detrimental, that students are more focused on and stymied by their emotions rather than being able to deal with them, which is just so counterintuitive. I mean, you like to think, you know, if you gave kids a few tools, they'd be better off. And millions of dollars are being spent potentially doing the opposite. Yeah. I mean, that's
you actually
disappointing.
You summarized it better than I did. I don't know that it's counterintuitive. I guess it is. But let me put it this way. I read the article. It's persuasive. The way they explain it, it's not surprising, because the way these programs are, you know, broadly discussed proceed is that they sort of encourage people to really dwell on whatever their issues are, whatever issues they have, and it becomes elevated in a lot of children's minds to the idea that they have a condition or syndrome or disease, which is in itself not a positive unless that kind of diagnosis leads to a cure or a solution or a treatment. And there is no cure because there's no treatment. The best example they give is, you know, people are depressed. You can get depressed about certain things. But this kind of program encourages people to think of themselves, according to the article, in some cases, as depressed, when in fact, they're not suffering from depression. They're just, you know, they have some down situations, and it's particularly counterproductive because people walk out of it saying, gee, I suffer from depression, not much I can do about that. Or there's a limited thing I can do, a limited toolkit for that. And that doesn't leave anybody in a good place.
Or like the article we read in the Wall Street Journal a couple of months ago, the one about are men happier or women happier or whatever like that. And they said, you know, at any given moment, you stop to think about whether you're happy. Usually not happy, you know, so it's just like, you know, just kind of dwelling on, digging in and deciding, I'm not happy, this is not good, you know, and where do you go from here? And maybe, and you're right, maybe it's a disease.
Let me ask you this, because I don't remember that article as well as you do. Did the article say that women are more apt to reflect on whether they're happy and men are more likely to forge ahead? Is that
yes,
right?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
All right, well, let me just, can I pause there for a second?
Yeah.
I think that's right. I'm not saying which is the best way to go, but based on my limited experience,
do you remember the part of the article where the writer interviews the expert?
Yeah.
And, and asks, you know, is kind of astonished at some of the presuppositions or something. And the expert looks at her and says, well, are you happy? And she says, and she kind of doesn't react. And he says, no, you're not happy right now. You're concentrating. You're working on this interview. That doesn't mean you're unhappy. Yeah. Okay. So, it's in that vein, you know. But anyway, that regardless of all this mushing around about exploring your feelings, et cetera, or whatever, the idea that programs, once again, programs designed to help people, millions of dollars being spent and are not helping, is just
that's what, you know, obviously there's a little bit of a a pushback. Not everybody accepts that conclusion, but there seems to be a fair bit of support for that conclusion, at least in that order.
So, where do we go from here? Because I do acknowledge it seems to be a problem.
Well, the answer is we forge ahead. We wanted to discuss this Robert Indiana situation. We want to get into art. We have a couple of art points.
Yeah, of course. You know, this is not my best thing. Not only is it art, but it's also law, legalities,
the best states. Combination.
Okay, so, you know, which always, undermines my ability to explain a situation. The thing is, when Robert Indiana, you know, the artist, famous as sculptor, you might say, but I guess he's more than a sculptor, really. The big love sculpture, right, in Philadelphia and other places. He's famous for that. At a certain point in his life, he moves to Vinyl Haven, Maine, to escape from everything. He died and left his entire estate to the sole beneficiary, a foundation that he formed called, what is it called? Star of Hope. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of that foundation is to create a museum, create and maintain a museum out of his home/studio, which was an old, lodge of some sort, in Vinyl Haven.
Well, that's what the bequest said. I'm giving you the paintings, and here's what you're supposed to do with the paintings.
I'm giving you everything.
Take this lodge,
everything
that you
the
have,
buildings, and all my stuff, right, my collection.
Remodel the lodge that you have, and put all the paintings in it, and make that a Robert Indiana Museum.
Okay,
that's what the will
and
says.
And the foundation is in charge of all monies. You know, it's involved in royalties and things like that too, right? So there's a lawyer, and the lawyer hires an appraiser to appraise the value of the estate. Okay. He works for a year. He comes up with a number of, it is to be valued at $85 million and change. Okay. So that is kind of a problem.
Well, it's not a problem. It's only the problem.
Well, the problem is the foundation itself, which exists, thought they should have a second opinion.
Yeah, well, yes.
Okay, which makes some sense. So they hired somebody else, and that person came up with
$40 million.
Right.
Yes, but here's why they cared about what the valuation was, all right? You wouldn't get a second opinion unless you cared. And because they took the position, as supported by their own evaluation, which was much lower, that they didn't have enough money to create the museum Indiana wanted and house his art. That if it was worth $83 million, maybe. But if it's only worth $40 million, which is what the second appraiser said, then it's not doable. And what they would prefer to do, which happens to be what people in the town want to do, no coincidence, is to turn the lodge in the community into a community center and have a few Indiana paintings there.
But there's all this other weird stuff going on, Daniel.
Let's stop for a second. But I did. That's the dispute. Just so we're clear what the dispute is. Of course, there's going to be weird stuff. But what's the weird stuff you have in mind?
The weird stuff I have in mind is number one. So the lawyer, first of all, the lawyer hired his friend who was the appraiser.
Yeah.
Who is described in the newspaper to some extent as a guy without much real background.
Right.
He got into.
Worked in a prison.
He worked in a prison.
Yeah.
His boss was into antiquing.
Yeah.
And so, but eventually he opens his own antique business.
Right.
Okay. But he learned the ropes, under his boss in the prison. And he has some credentials. Basically he gets paid. He works on this for a year. He gets paid $280,000.
Right.
Okay. The next person who's hired to do it has more, seems to have more credentials.
Right.
Okay. She took a couple of months to do it And she earned... She
did it more quickly and she charged less money.
And her fee was $40,000.
The difference between $40,000 and $208,000 is insignificant here. I mean, the real thing is that the lawyer is charging $10 million.
Yeah, and they say that's related also to all kinds of litigation they have to do disputes about royalties and rights to produce, the images, et cetera. It's a popular image.
All right, so look. No one really cares what the lawyer is getting paid. They've already knocked down what the lawyer is getting paid. But the lawyer is pushing the higher figure, number one, because the higher figure is consistent with what Indiana wanted, which was a museum, and that's his client, his executor of the will. But also, to the extent the estate is worth more, that justifies the lawyer's higher fees. That's what that's about. And the town wants the lower figure because the lower figure supports their position that there will be no Robert Indiana Museum, and the town doesn't want a Robert Indiana Museum. So that's where we are.
That's kind of funny. They say it's because they didn't like him.
Right.
they make remarks that people always say, like, there'll be crowds, blah, blah. There's not going to be crowds.
No, there's not going to be crowds.
There's not going to be busloads of people coming to
They want a community center. Robert. And they want to spend, they want to build a community center with Robert Indiana's money.
But it's just kind of sad, isn't it? I mean, you think of poor Robert Indiana thinking, this will be my legacy. My stuff will be here forever.
You know what it reminds me of a little bit? There's a thing of the Music Man, where at one point the Music Man, Professor Harold Hill, is talking to the woman who's sort of a lead gossip. And she's criticizing the librarian, Marion the librarian. The Music Man is pursuing romantically. He says, she made friends with that terrible person. That terrible, terrible person, Miser Madison. And the Music Man says, Miser Madison? You mean Madison Hospital? As in Madison Field? Madison Library? And she says, yes, that Miser Madison. And he says, well, I should say. Same idea. I mean, they're going to take Robert Indiana's money and make a community center.
A community center would be.
Whatever. All right, so you had a museum food article.
We're already to that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, just a couple of museum food tidbits. There's an article in the New York Times, just today, about inspiring food choices come with world-class art. And it talks about going to the Brooklyn Museum, what you can eat there, what you can eat at the Museum of Modern Art. And I've just picked out a couple here. Cafe Sabarsky at the Neue Gallery, which is a delightful gallery, which is mentioned in the article. It is, what did it say? The teeny tiny Neue Gallery is by far the most digestible museum in the city, filled with incredible works by Klimt, Egon Schiele, and other German and Austrian artists, okay? And has a beloved Austrian cafe on the ground floor. That is so absolutely true. It's up on 5th Avenue near 86th Street. And this article mentions that they have 18 different desserts. 18 desserts on the menu, okay? So I cannot think of a nicer way to spend an afternoon than to go to Central Park, stroll around. You're up to the area, 86th Street, you could see the obelisk, Cleo's Needle, or whatever you want to do. Walk over to the museum, check out the artworks, whether it's Klimt or the German Expressionists or whatever, and then have a nice piece of pastry and a cup of wonderful coffee would be terrific. And I've done pretty much that several times. Also, they mention the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The article mentions actually going to see the Harlem Renaissance and Transatlantic Modernism, which is a great, great fun show. We'll be there through July 28th. And for food, there's fine dining on the fourth floor. I've never been to the fine dining at the Met. Okay. But guess who's the chef now? Bill Telepan.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's very hard. It's booked
Well, I meant
constantly in advance. So you have to kind of plan ahead for that. But say this is the perfect take your parents or grandparents to lunch and an art show restaurant. And also, I'm just going to mention that at the New York Historic Society, where they're having that show called Lost New York, Fridays through June, they're offering jazz and juice starting at 5 p.m.
You know, you mentioned the Met. We're not going to discuss this because we haven't talked about it and I don't know anything about it. But one day you'll explain the Met Gala to me because I don't get it. It's like reading about developments on Venus. I mean, I don't.
Well, that, you know, the Met Gala is a fundraiser for the Costume Institute.
Right.
And the Costume Institute, that finances the Costume Institute.
And the
Institute.
Way you go.
Yeah.
The Costume
Institute is not.
You spend a few hundred thousand dollars per ticket to go. That's literally the way it's
so they make
to work.
A huge amount of money and a huge amount of publicity. Right. It's a win-win-win-win.
Yeah, except that it's the stupidest thing I've ever seen in my
That's
entire life.
That's fine. So it's stupid to you, but, you know,
I'm not saying
anytime,
they shouldn't have it. I'm not saying they shouldn't have it, but I wouldn't call it win-win-win-win. I
it's
say
win-win-win-win
stupid.
Anytime you can have any kind of institution like that, self-supporting
there's another trick here.
If your theater could raise money the way the Costume Institute raises money with their gala, you know.
But I don't even know why. I don't understand anything about it.
It's just a funny thing. It's crazy.
You would only pay that money because the publicity helps you in some way. I don't know how it helps you. But
it makes money.
I don't know.
No, the publicity? Oh, sure.
You think so?
People love the publicity.
They get dressed up as fools and that's good publicity?
Which people are you citing as fools?
Most of them. The outfits are ridiculous.
The outfits can be, you know, not very functional.
Right.
Okay. But they seem very glamorous.
No.
And they're very flattering.
No.
They're very, you know.
Okay. Well, anyway. Out of my field. Football. You wanted to meet a just follow up.
Well, you were blabbing and blabbing about
Gaelic football
kickers.
All right. And then
now your Giants have signed one.
They signed a guy
named thought you should mention it.
Jude McAtamy, who is from Northern Ireland, who was he played for Derry, which was in 2018 won the cup for the under-20 Gaelic football championship. So he's the real deal. His background is he actually wanted to pursue the notion of being a place kicker in the U.S. He was trained in Australia for that, strangely. And then he went to a small school in North Carolina and transferred to Rutgers and spent the last 2 years at Rutgers.
So he's local.
Except here's the trick, though. 2022, he's the place kicker for Rutgers. 2023, he's beaten out as the place kicker for Rutgers. He's not. They let him kick off because he kicks a long way, but he's not accurate enough to be the place kicker. Doesn't make any difference. The Giants hold a tryout for anybody, not just Gaelic football players, as they tend to do. There are a lot of so-called pro days in which people who want to be on the team try out. And he makes 10 for 10 of his kicks. They sign him. They signed him the other day.
So he's finally caught on.
He's caught on. He'll be on the practice squad. There's something called the practice squad, guys who don't get in the game, but they're there in case someone gets hurt. And if he continues to kick well, he will be the kicker on the practice squad.
It's funny that he couldn't kick well at Rutgers and now he can.
Well, these guys are constantly training, constantly learning. The league is filled with guys who weren't able to make a team when they were 20, 21, 22, 23, and then 25, they had enough technique and they become very successful kickers. It's like a golf swing or something. So anyway, look forward to Jude McAtan, the Gaelic football player for the Giants. Probably kicks the ball a long way.
So back to Zeke's house. We're at Zeke's house.
Yes, this is our
last
story.
And Zeke does not have any cable contracts. And you remarked on this as we're getting close to his house because there's basketball championships going on.
There's all
kinds of stuff going on.
It's not cable contracts. He doesn't have over-the-air television.
Okay. But if you had a cable contract, you would have that.
No, not necessarily. But you could. But the point is, the easiest thing in the world is to have over-the-air television. If you have an antenna, it's free.
All right. So when we go to Zeke's house,
television blackout.
We can watch Frozen as many times as we want to. Yes. We can watch Bluey. But we cannot watch sports.
We can't watch
which
sports.
Which is, you know, kind of cold turkey for you.
Yeah.
So you were a little bit panicked, but first we get there, and almost immediately you figured out how to get the NBA game.
Yes. It's on Max.
Which was brilliant. No, we didn't have to pay any
Max
extra.
Max had NBA. It's yeah. crazy.
Okay, so he was already signed
so
up for that.
I watched the game. Yeah.
Okay. And then the big problem comes.
Kentucky Derby.
Kentucky
Saturday,
Derby.
Saturday. And then we actually, Zeke had to put his hand in his pocket. This doesn't happen a lot. And sign up for Peacock at $5 a month just to get the Kentucky Derby. There was no other way. We had a lot of bootleg channels which weren't going to be able to work. And we got the
but
Derby.
But because we had promised to babysit.
Yeah, he got the Derby. And...
He was putty in your hands.
Not exactly. But it was a great, the point is, it was worth the $5. It was a great Derby.
Right. Turned on the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah. And okay. So let me tell you a couple things about the Derby, and then we'll sign off. Number one, it was the 150th running of the Derby. Number two, it was the largest viewing audience for the Derby.
I was going to say they had like 156,000.
They had 150,000 people there who paid, by the way, $150 each to get in and paid $22 for a mint julep if they wanted a drink. But beyond that, the viewing public, like us, was the largest audience they've had in 35 years. I don't know why. And they're going over the and they've just refurbished the Churchill Downs, the track. And they're going over the various horses. And I have all this scientific information, who's supposed to win. In particular, Fierceness is the favorite. And he's got credentials that are head and shoulders above every other horse. And you say, oh!
No.
What? You tell it.
No, so you're explaining to me. First of all, there was some tension.
Yeah.
Because we had been watching some, you know, illegal bootleg feeds
yeah.
on YouTube,
yeah.
okay, which got cut off
uh-huh.
as you get close to actual post time,
right?
So it was at the last minute that Zeke was quickly signing up for the service and trying to remember which credit card went with the, you know, and so on. And so at the very last minute, we get the feed. We're watching the horses, you know, come to the gates.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got your little patter. This is the one that's the favorite. Fierce something or whatever
yes.
it was. And the next horse, you know, the horse comes up. I said, oh, Dan, there's a horse called Mystic Dan. Why aren't you rooting for him? And you growled at me and said, I don't choose horses that way.
And it's an uncanny impression.
And I said, well, I do. And so there I am rooting for Mystic Dan. And of course,
Mystic Dan wins. And in the closest Derby of all time, three horses within what they call a nose at the very end of the race. Sierra Leone, Forever Young, coming in second and third. And you look at the photo. I mean, I look at it even now. It took them 10 minutes with the photo to figure out who the winner was. Three horses with a nose. What an incredible race. Mystic Dan hung on.
But it was great to watch because as your horse slid to the back out of nowhere, my horse was creeping up on the rail and yeah. just staying there.
Yeah.
It was fabulous. Yes, out of nowhere.
Great race. All right, we'll see. The Preakness, Mystic Dan hasn't committed to the Preakness yet, but well, we shall see. All right, so there's a lot to look forward to, Preakness and everything else. Until next time.
This is Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuhoff.
Tamsin and Dan read the paper.
See ya.